Okay. Does everybody have the class on Rehoboam? Good. Okay. In reading Rehoboam, particularly the first account of it as it starts out in 1 Kings, reminds me in the book of Samuel, the first letter that of Samuel, chapter 8, where the people at first asked for a king and God warned them what it was going to be like under a king, the demands that the king would place upon them. And perhaps those demands really started under under Solomon. And not saying that Rehoboam was guilty of all those things that Samuel warned that the kings would require of them, but certainly it's a reminder and the fulfillment of God really bringing out what we're like as human beings. And that's kind of the mindset as we go into the lesson tonight. You see Rehoboam getting two sets of advice in the beginning of this study for tonight. What was the first advice that he received? Lighten the load. And who did that advice come from? They were the older advisors under who had been under Solomon. And so, and their words in lighten the load was that, it says in verse 7, if you will be a servant to this people today, what will the people do? Go ahead. Be a servant to you forever. Okay. So, how do you correlate this concept of a king being a servant? How do you correlate it? What do kings expect? Pardon? Subjection, yeah. And so we see that in the monarchies today or in history, we see, you know, a service by the people. But here it says, if you would serve this people, they will serve you. Is that kind of a misnomer? If you serve them, they will serve you. Okay? So how do we bring the concept of king and servant and service together?
Authority is always for the good of the government.
Okay. And that's true. We see that really throughout any government. Well, let's back up a second. Who is the greatest king that the world has ever had and will ever have?
Solomon.
She says Solomon.
Christ.
Let's use Christ. Okay, he's king. He's our king. Was he a servant? In what way was he a servant? He died for us. So now do we serve him? Okay. We serve him because of the service that he gave us. Okay. So there's a correlation between being a king and being a service. We think of them as disjoint. Okay. Is there application you can make of that? Outside of government, is there an application that we can make? I'm sorry? Better to be a servant than a ruler? Okay. But if rulers are servants, then they're servants. Christ was a servant. Think of a father. A father has authority. Okay. What's the best thing that a father can do for his family? Is it to stand up using that authority?
It's the way in which you lead, the way you use the authority.
Okay. Okay.
You can rule, yes, harshly, or you can rule, like I said, by example.
Okay.
Love and understanding.
Mm-hmm. So, a man has authority, but his role is really one of service. Look at the mother. What does it say about the mother? Does she not rule the house? How does she do that? Is it through service? This concept of authority and rule and of service is something that is really through the scriptures. We can look at it in the church with elders. The rule of elders, they set the example. They serve. And through their service, we ourselves see how to lead and submit to them. Look in Matthew 20. Can anybody say what the occasion of Jesus' discussion in Matthew 20, beginning in verse 25 through 28? What, can anybody say what is going on at this moment that brings up this discussion? What had the mother of James and John asked for? I'm sorry?
Her sons to be first.
Okay. One to sit on the right and one to sit on the left when Jesus came in his kingdom. Okay? So, what's her idea of greatness? High position? Well, yeah. Yeah, favoritism, high position with people under you, people to be subjugated to you and for you to dictate to. And is that not common, the idea of greatness? Somebody works for a company and they got so many people working for them. If a person has only five under him but another person has 500, well, we see the greatness of that person with 500 under him. That's our association so many times is along those lines. But who did Jesus say thinks that way? The world, and particularly in this version uses the word the Gentiles. He says the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority among them. But then he goes on to say in verse 26, it shall not be so among you, you see. Among followers of Christ, in the kingdom of Christ, it's not that way. So we've got the way of the world and we got the way of Christ, and they're different. The way of the world, greatness is by being over people and them being subjected to you and you just tell them what to do. You've got the authority. In the rule of Christ, greatness is not that way. And he goes on to say what it is. But whosoever would be great among you must be your what? Servant. And whosoever first among you must be your what? Slave. Okay. And then he gives himself as example. The Son of Man came for what reason?
To serve.
Okay. So we've got the way of the world. We've got the way of Christ. Okay. The way of Christ is we achieve greatness through service. And in that light, everyone can be great. See, in the Gentile world, you've only got a few that are great, because only a few can hold those positions, and everybody else is subject to them. But in the kingdom of Christ, every one of us can be great. And we ourselves are the only determinant if we're great or not. It's not like in the business world where your accomplishments got to be recognized by somebody, and there's got to be a position, and you work your way up to those positions. Not that way. But every one of us can be great. Up to us if we choose for ourselves to be a servant or not. That makes sense. It's simple when you put it that way. So what keeps it from being that way?
The world.
The world. The Gentile world. Okay. So, yeah, the ruler is to look after the people. But oftentimes they don't. Jesus gave the example of service to his disciples. It was on the earlier in the verse I didn't go to, John 13. And did anybody look to see what John 13 brings out? This was an example of humility that Jesus showed them. It was a great example of humility, an example that they didn't understand. And matter of fact, Jesus, you know, he said, no, you're not going to do this. What was that? When he had them gathered, and he took a bowl and he went around to each of them, he started to wash their feet. You see? And he said to them, let me get the right chapter. He said in verse 15 or verse 14, if I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. I've given you this as an example that you should do just as I have done. Then he says in verse 16, truly, truly. And there's emphasis on that. See, there's something that you need to understand. Remember in school when the instructor was going over maybe the test, you're having a test review, and they might stomp their feet when something important is being said? You know, they're not going to tell you what's on the test, but they will stomp their feet, you know, at the right moment. You know, I got to remember that. Well, I look at expressions like truly, truly as a foot stomper. Jesus said something following this that we need to pay attention to. Truly, truly, I say unto you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. So, again, the lesson, you know, of greatness, you see, comes through service. So what would you say about these two terms? Are they complementary terms, or are they contrasting terms? What would you say? Maybe it depends on who you're asking. If you're asking the Gentile world, they're going to be contrasting terms. They're going to conflict with one another. But in the kingdom of Christ, these terms go together. Your station in life does not remove you from service, you see, to others. So it's a kingdom of service. Okay, after Rehoboam talked with these older men, and he rejected their counsel, who did he go to then? The young one, okay, the young men, okay. And in chapter 12, it says in verse 8 that he went to the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. Now, it looks to me like this is kind of the way a lot of politics is run. You've got, in this case, older men that had been with Solomon, and they experienced Solomon's rule and the relationship with the people. And they saw what needed to be done. And then you've got Rehoboam bringing into his reign his own men. And they're younger men. And so, you know, when you associate wisdom with age, you would say they're not as wise. Perhaps more rebellious, less responsible. But regardless, he asked them, and what did they say do?
Raise the taxes.
Raise the taxes. And listen, I don't want to say anything that fits into our own political, what's going on now in politics. If I do, it's not intended to make a connection. So you've got one saying have a lighter load on the people and the people will serve you. You've got another one saying be more harsh on the people, raise the taxes, and don't worry about them serving you. It's not their job to serve them. Their job is to serve you. And so which outlook is that? Is that the outlook of Christ or is that the outlook of the world? It's the outlook of the world. So
it's interesting, this principle you're developing. Certainly true to most Christians, that's obviously true to most Christians. But it's a principle that if we have the right to rule, whether Christian or not Christian, outside the realm of Christ, which is something God expects of people, civil authority, makes no difference. It's interesting, in fact, when we're studying Job made that very point about him being a master of slaves. He said, if I have despised the chamber of my male or female slaves, they filed a complaint against me. What then could I do to God or right? But basically, that was far before Christ. And so, Christ taught his apostles what he taught in Matthew 20 and also in John 13. It's a principle. It's true all the way back to 1 Kings 12. It's making a difference. What area of life it is, men can understand, and women, when they have rulers to serve those they rule, make the world a better place, make their life a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, in his consultation, who did he not consult with? God. Okay. And this is going to be something to look for throughout these kings. Look at who they talked to, and you'll see. You'll see the kings that consulted with God, and you'll see the difference in their lives because they did. And you'll see times when perhaps they did not consult with God, and you'll see what happened in their lives. It's a concept to look for in this study of going to God, either going to God through prayer, through one of his prophets, but going to God, you see. Going to his word and examining what his word has to say, but in one way or the other, or combination of ways, going to God. And we'll see that. We'll develop that thought in some of the others as we go through. And the last question I ask is just one for your own thinking. And it's obviously not one we're going to discuss, but it's one that I would really encourage you to think about. All of us have to make decisions. Some important, some not important, on the scale of things. But really, decisions that we make in life, decisions that affect ourselves, decisions that affect our family. Do we go to God? Do we think of Him? Does He have any consideration? And what we're going to see as we go through this, we're going to see that a lot of what we think about what we need to do is really dependent upon our faith, our own faith, how strong it is. Because the answer to what we need to do is different for a person with faith than it is for a person without faith. And we'll develop that some as the examples is come through. Any thought or any comment on this portion of the lesson? I'm glad Steve brought up that about Job. I remember that when we went through it, but I'd forgotten that example. And it's a good example. Any other comment before we move on? Okay. In the Second Chronicles account, and now keep in mind something I said last week. These two accounts are different, even though we kind of think, because there's enough similarity between Kings and Chronicles, that they're the same. They're not the same. You'll learn that the Chronicles accounts does not consider the tribes of Israel, except as they have some relationship to the tribes of nation of Judah, particularly the tribe of Judah. So, in that light, you don't really see anything about Israel over there. You see almost entirely about the nation of Judah. But it brings out different points, okay? Has a different perspective. Particularly in the Chronicles accounts, it may bring out more that has to do with the priesthood than what the King's account brings out. And in some of those readings, we'll spend some time looking at just exactly what Chronicles brings out. Now, this is something here that Chronicles brings out more than Kings does, or at least I want to refer to it from Chronicles rather than Kings. And that is this concept of Rehoboam securing his kingdom. Now, we had, in this time frame, Jeroboam had become king, and we're going to study that, Lord willing, Sunday. And you had the tribes that went with Jeroboam. But did all of the people that were all those tribes stay with Jeroboam? Okay. Who did not stay? Some of the Levites, some of the priests, and then who else? Okay. Beginning down in verse 13 of 2 Chronicles 11, the priests and the Levites who were in Israel presented themselves to him from all the places where they lived. This would be Rehoboam. For the Levites left something. What did they leave? Their possessions. Now, would you call this a step of faith? You see, to leave behind what you've got. All the things that you've amassed, says they're common lands and holdings, the things that you have come to possess, would you leave all of that behind to go, in this case it was to Judah, but it was under another king, so that you could serve God? But that's what they did. And they did that because Jeroboam was doing what? Setting up idols and setting up a priesthood from another order, and not from the order of Aaron. Okay? And then in 16, it's like Steve said, those who had set their hearts to seek the Lord God of Israel came after them from all the tribes of Israel to Jerusalem to sacrifice to the Lord. So others came with them, but these were people who had determined within themselves that they were going to serve God. I don't know what you think of when you think of this. One group of people that comes to my mind is we read in the book of Daniel some young men who went to another nation, to Babylon. And they set their minds, you see, to serve God. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. And you can read through scriptures of others who did not let where they were stop them from serving God. But in all cases, their choice to serve God required them to act upon that faith, to do something about it, you see. And in their case here, doing something about it meant they left their possessions and came down to Jerusalem. On a question, let me get the question numbers on the previous page for me. Question 9 and point number E. I asked the question, what can like-minded people accomplish? And I list several verses there. What had Ezra set his mind to do? Three things. One was to study, one was to do, and one was to teach the law of God. And so you can read through the book of Ezra, and you can get, you know, the feel for what he did in doing that. But he set his heart to do that. Now, I mentioned Luke 17. I think I meant to put Matthew 17. And there he's talking to his disciples where he's talking to them about what even a little bit of faith can accomplish. But we have to have faith. And we have to work on that faith. What I mean by work on it is allow that faith to work within us and to lead us and to guide us. That is you know, the lesson that I get as far as application, you know, to me. In John chapter 8, you know, a person can determine that he wants to have a relationship with God and study the scriptures and learn that he can be free from sin. We can have Paul's insight into the mystery of Christ. You know, the Ephesian letter talks about if we want to know God's word, we can do it. But we're not going to know God's word without setting our heart to know what his word is. And those are ideas that I have when I think of, you know, this concept. Acts 4, what was going on with the church in Jerusalem in Acts 4 as far as its needs? What we've got, the early days of the church, people had come from different nations and they became Christians. And, pardon? Well, what I'm looking at specifically is that that the church was taking care of the needy among their number. Okay? And they had quite a needy, but they were doing it, even if it meant selling their possessions. You see, we had the Levites and the priests in the days of Rehoboam, leaving their possessions. Now here in Acts 4, we've got the Christians selling their possessions. So we see that they see what's important, and they're willing to separate themselves from not. So they have a faith, but it's not the faith that does nothing. It's a faith that leads them to do something. Acts 8. What's happening at the close of Acts 7 and the beginning of Acts 8? What's happening there?
Persecution.
And so what's the reaction of the Christian Jerusalem? To go home and lock the doors and be quiet? Or do they do something else? What do? Okay. They went down into throughout Judea and Samaria, you see, teaching. And so again, you know, we see that people who set their hearts to serve God, to please God, all find ways to serve God even during times of adversity. And they did here in the days of Rehoboam. They left Jeroboam. They left the adversity there under his rule, and because they were determined to serve God. So people of faith will find a way to serve God no matter the circumstance that they're in. Any comment or question? Now let me ask you this. What was the effect of this group that came down from Israel? And I'm looking at verse 17 of 2 Chronicles 11. What was the effect that they had upon the kingdom of Judah? Anybody got it? They strengthened it. Okay, for how long?
3 years.
For 3 years. And it says for 3 years they walked in the way of David and Solomon. Now, I want you to look back up at the beginning of this chapter. Here we've got Rehoboam, 180,000 warriors from the Judah and Benjamin. It lists these 15 cities or so that he builds and sets up his defense to take care of the nation, provide for them. Okay, so that's what Jeroboam does. Okay, to provide safety, it says in verse 11, he made the fortresses strong, put commanders in them, and stored goods in them, put shields and spears in all the cities, and made them feel very strong. So he held Judah and Benjamin. That would be held them against anybody that would try to take them away. Now, look, if you will, in chapter 12 of 2 Chronicles, verse 1. It says, when the rule of Rehoboam was established, and then what does it say after that? What did he do when his rule was established? Okay. He became strong. He was strong, and he abandoned the law of the Lord and Israel with him. In other words, he felt that the strength and security they had was his own doing, was the building of these defense cities and the stocking of them, you see. And that's where he was looking for his strength. So, we see then that he's lifted by his own pride over what he's done. So what happened in the fifth year of his reign? Okay, king from Egypt came. Okay, Shishak. Okay. And in verse 5, Shemaiah the prophet came to Rehoboam and said, you abandoned me, so I've abandoned you to the land of Shishak. And what happened to Rehoboam and the princes after that? What did they do? Okay, they humbled themselves before God. And then God relented upon a total destruction of Jerusalem, but he did allow Egypt to come in and carry off some bounty and so forth. But he spared he spared the city. Now, what age was Rehoboam when this happened?
46.
By my figures, he would have been 46. He was 41 when he became king, and this was in the fifth year when Shishak came. It was after 3 years that he felt his strength. So God allowed a little bit of time from the time that he began to abandon God, the time his pride was setting in, till actually God judged him through Egypt coming against him. I make a comment in your study guide, in what year was reign, what was his age, and then I say, remember this age. We're not going to make a lot of comment about it, but as you go through this study, there's several things that happen, and you can look at the ages and perhaps start to make a correlation, and we'll do some of that as we go through. Now, what was the sin of Rehoboam? I referred you to 1 John chapter 2. And I look at it as, you know, he was lifting himself up. It's the sin of pride. And that can happen to all of us. It can happen to, certainly to successful people, as Rehoboam was. The nation of Judah was well defensed. And as we look in, we can see some other writings that Rehoboam and Jeroboam had several battles. Yet he maintained his country. Okay, so a person can begin to look at them themselves as their own strength rather than to God, and thus we have what we call the sin of pride. Sometimes we don't give enough thought to the sin of pride. We're more into maybe immorality or theft or something like that. And those things are wrong. Don't misunderstand me. Sometimes the basis of some of those sins may be pride. That it was pride that may have caused someone to do something. Certainly in our lives, we need to look at pride. Oftentimes, when our tongue lashes out, what really is behind it is pride. Not wanting to be felt that, you know, we said something wrong, but yet, and somebody's corrected us, but we don't want the impression that, you know, we were wrong. Or we lose our temper over something that's really a matter of pride than anything else. Pride causes more trouble in our lives than we give it credit for. And so I use this opportunity to ask you to look into your own life. It certainly was a part, in my thinking, of Rehoboam's life when he started to look to his own strength and not giving credit to God. Any comment or question?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. It was built in from the beginning. You know, perhaps it was always there, but notice, you know, the verse that we read back in the 2 Chronicles 11:17, it seemed to be this godly influence of people that lasted for 3 years that kept, I'll use the term, kept his pride in check. I don't know if that's the best way to put it or not. But certainly, for those 3 years, there seemed to be a service to God out of his kingdom that was more characteristic of those 3 years. But certainly, the point that his pride was an issue with him goes back to when he first became king. Then it began to manifest itself, perhaps, after the third year, and God took action against him in the fifth year. Any other comment? Okay, we'll pick back up over some of the other questions then that we've got in the handout that, one thing with Rehoboam that you don't see, at least I didn't see it, is I never saw him consult God. I don't read of him consulting God. Now, in Deuteronomy 17, what God said that the kings were to do was they were to know the Word of God. They were to have it written, they were to know it, and they were to consult it. But I never see that with Rehoboam. Never see that interest from him in really what God had to say. And it showed in the initial, and it showed in the later years of his reign. When you look at did Rehoboam have a choice about losing the 10 tribes? In other words, if Rehoboam had answered correctly to the older men and said, "I'll lighten the load, I'll do as you say," would he still have lost those 10 tribes? I agree. I think he would have. Because that was prophesied already back in the 1 Kings 11 that that 10 tribes were going to go to Jeroboam. But would that have kept the kingdom of Rehoboam from prospering? And I suggest to you that the answer to that is no. It wouldn't have kept it from prospering. He may not have had, and I don't think he did, have a choice about losing the 10 tribes. Because that was brought on by what Solomon did, not by what Rehoboam did or didn't do. But as far as the tribes that he has, it normally speaks of it as just Judah. And you can see in certain verses it will throw in Benjamin, which makes up the 12, if that was causing any of you any thought. But he did have a choice about the prospering of that kingdom, you see. And that was going to be his choice to serve God or not to serve God. And he made the choice ultimately not to serve God, and thus Egypt came down upon them. So he had choice, even though some of the choice that he had was not his choice, other choice he did have. Look in 1 Kings chapter 12. Let me see if I want to go to Kings or Chronicles. Yeah, let's go to 1 Kings 12. Well, I guess we won't. Okay. Next week, we'll pick up with the next handout, Jeroboam. Thanks.